When it comes to sustainability, it's hard to argue with results. For Susan Watkins Farm, that means seven generations and counting of stewarding highly productive farmland dating back to before the Civil War.
We farm Five Forks. So Five Forks was pretty instrumental towards the end of the Civil War, and we actually farm on that original land too. The house is still standing. The owners of the house, they still have the portraits from their ancestors, and it has slash marks through the portraits where the soldiers came in and slashed them. So yes, a lot of rich history here.
Today we get to talk about that rich history and the soil health building practices that Susan Watkins is implementing on her farm in Central Virginia. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning into Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Virginia farmer Susan Watkins. Susan farms in Dinwiddie County, which is in the central part of the state, about 40 miles southwest of Richmond. Along with her husband, Maxwell, and their youngest son, Cody, Susan grows soybeans, corn, and wheat on about 3,500 acres. A lot of that ground is rented, but they still farm some of the original land that was granted by the King of England to the Watkins family at least seven generations ago. Pretty incredible. We talked to Susan about this rich history, their legacy of caring for the soil over the years, how they transitioned to no-till over 20 years ago and added cover crops about 15 years ago, and what she's looking forward to next, including the use of more biological inputs. First, though, we'll start with some additional historical context on that land that they farm today.
Well, unfortunately, in Dinwiddie County, the county we're located in, the courthouse burned, so there's not as many records as we would like. But we have kind of traced it back to this. But yeah, we think it was back in the 1700s. It was a land grant to the Watkins family. And actually, one of his grandfathers, great-great-great-grandfather along the way, was in Richmond when Patrick Henry gave his famous speech of "Give me liberty or give me death." He was the representative from Dinwiddie County at the time.
Wow. With that history, you know, usually we like to ask about, like, how has the soil changed over time? You have a whole lot of time there to reflect on how the soil might have changed. And I don't know if we can even speculate, you know, what it might have looked like back in those days. But, you know, has soil health always, whether it was called that or not, always been sort of a priority for the family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, we're at least seventh generation with my husband. And you can't hit those milestones if you're not using good practices on your operation. You know, we can go back to fourth grade history for Virginia. The Native Americans was teaching the settlers, you know, when they planted the corn, you put a fish beside it. So there was fertilization efforts long time ago. It's just everything has changed since then. And Virginia is very diverse, where there's many soil types and a lot of diverse crops. We're not Iowa, so you're basically corn, soybeans. You know, there's so many different crops that we can produce here.
Right. And tell us about the farm today. You kind of gave a few details about it, but just tell us more about the farming operation and you know, the family that you farm it with.
Yeah, like I said, it's my husband's family farm. He and I took ownership. He was 32, I was 30. His father unfortunately passed away from leukemia at an early age, and we purchased the farm from his mother. And most of our acres are rented. With the original farm, we probably have around 200 acres. But again, we farm about 3,500 in this area. So we're constantly growing. You know, we're very, you know, innovative, trying new practices, trying new technologies, you know, to improve soil, plant, and yields.
And did you take over some of those leases when you started farming from your father-in-law, or has the leased acreage, you know, kind of all been accumulated over those years?
Oh, we've grown it. Yeah, we kept some of the same landlords, picked up new landlords, and you know, we've been very fortunate that we have a good group of people that we work with.
And talk about cover crops. Are cover crops common in your area? And are you all working with cover crops? And if so, kind of how did that start?
Yes, we have been using cover crops for a long time now. We started out with no-till just for the benefits of, you know, reduced time, input cost, saving on input cost, trying to, again, reduce compaction, reduce the number of trips across the field. And it's been very beneficial, the no-till system. And then we incorporated the cover crops. And we did this before programs were established. We saw this being a good way to improve our soils moving forward. And now, of course, programs are involved that will, you know, that we benefit also.
And do you recall about what year it was you started the no-till and then what year you brought in the cover crops?
I would say cover crops probably been about 15 years. No-till was probably, you know, 20, 25 years ago.
And over that time, Susan, what kinds of sort of impact or changes have you seen as a result?
We've seen that the benefits are just reduced passes on the fields, you know, water retention. And one big benefit of cover crops is we want to keep that soil alive 365 days a year if we can. You know, we don't want that soil sitting dormant. So if we have a cover crop growing, that soil is working year round. And that's what we're trying to accomplish.
And when I think of Virginia, I think very green. Like in my mind, it kind of rains there all the time. But you said kind of water retention is one important aspect of these crops. So can you talk about the importance of that in your local context? Why is water retention so important?
In central Virginia, we're not totally flat, but we're also not mountainous. But we do have some rolling, you know, fields. And that water retention, again, it reduces the runoff. And we are located within the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So we want to reduce the runoff. We also want to, you know, keep the fields intact. In some of our fields, we've established waterways, you know, to help with that.
And over this time of doing kind of the no-till and cover crops last couple decades, you know, what has been the most challenging part of implementing it in your operation? A lot of times we could talk, you know, on this show about how important it is and how valuable it is, but it's always different, it seems like, in how you implement it and what challenges you face. What was challenging for you all in kind of implementing some of these practices?
I wouldn't say it was that bad. We saw benefits early on and, you know, we just continued to pursue it. And, you know, Dinwiddie County has been very active in no-till and cover crops. And some of our crops require strip-till, our cotton. You know, you'll do a strip-till on that because you have a longer taproot. Again, we try to minimize the impact on the soil as much as possible.
And has there been anything that maybe wasn't challenging, but surprised you or something that kind of turned out to be unexpected for you?
I think when you think the soil is not being disturbed, you know, that will set up like really hard and it will be unmanageable, unworkable. But it's actually, it becomes to me a richer soil and it is easier to work with. Again, it's just building our organic matter. You know, you are, the moisture is there. It just works up really nice.
Did we talk about where you kind of fit cover crops into the rotation? Because you said you're corn, soybean, wheat, and is it typically after wheat? Or I know you can do some double cropping in that area too, but where do you fit your cover crops in and what are you trying?
Well, and we do our cover crops in fall of the year. We do plant wheat as a rotational crop. And of course, we harvest that in June. But our cover crops, we have gotten so now that's been the only challenge. I guess if you want to go back to a challenge, there is a timeline. And we are harvesting at the same time as when you should be putting out cover. So what we've done in the past several years, we have a high clearance spreader. So we actually go out, spread the cover while the beans are still standing. So with that, you know, you're getting the protection of the leaves dropping. You know, you get good emergence even before the combine goes in the field. So that's worked out really well.
What are you spreading in the soybean before leaf drop? What cover crops?
We're doing northern rye. And it seems that it's easier to control because sometimes, you know, in the spring of the year, we might not be able to get into the field, you know, again, in a timely manner, but it just, we can control it a little bit better. It doesn't get away from us.
And you mentioned the strip tillage on the cotton. Is that the only crop that you're strip tilling or are you using that elsewhere as well?
we used to raise tobacco, and we used to strip till and tobacco also. And what's amazing is when we would go and you do a strip till and you plant the tobacco, you know, the field would be flat. But then we could come back in and cultivate, and we could build the beds back up, even from a no-till beginning.
And I'm curious, you mentioned that your son also farms with you. Is that right? And how has that been kind of the, you know, succession of the farm going on another generation, which will, what, be like eighth or so generation on the farm? That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, he's just like my husband. That's all he's ever wanted to do is farm. You know, our youngest son's always ever wanted to do his farm. He's almost 34 now, and he actually bought in the high clearance spreader. We use that here on the farm, and he also does custom work in this area. So that it's actually been a benefit, and it's gave him a sideline business, but we're also trying to pull him in, you know, to the business, you know, with him being young. We want him to be active and be a part of it.
This is something that came up for me the other day about kids coming back to the farm. Maybe they go off to school and they come back and they bring new ideas. And what does that look like for your family on your farm when your sons bring back these, you know, different ideas? And how do you process those and then integrate them into the operation?
He did the two-year program at Virginia Tech also. He did the associate's program. And to be honest, he will tell you it's the connections he made. Because at Virginia Tech, it's more livestock related, I think, as far as the two-year program goes. But he made some really valuable connections. You know, they communicate and they help each other out. And I think that's where farming needs to go. I read something recently. You want your fellow farmer to do well, your neighbor, because, you know, that will pass into your fields. Around us, Palmer was a big deal. Luckily, we did not have issues with it, but if we don't address it and help other farmers address it, then it does create a huge problem. So we have to work together on stuff like that.
And what got you involved with the United Soybean Board?
I'm on the Virginia Soybean Board. I was appointed to that probably 8 years ago. And from there, they needed someone. Somebody was coming off the board. They asked if I would participate. And at first, wasn't sure about it, but I'm so pleased I did it. It's been an invaluable experience. I can't express what I've learned and the people I've met. And hopefully I'll get to fulfill the whole term. You can serve 9 years. I'm in my fourth year now.
That's great. And from that experience, you know, to an audience of probably a lot of other soybean growers, how has your perspective changed about the industry since getting involved in leadership?
I think we all have our challenges. We're all farmers. We all want to preserve our lands, you know, and pass it along to our children if possible. And that's the goal of everyone. But the margins are so slim, we have to be conscious of, you know, new technologies, new ideas, and adapt to those. You know, we can't stay stuck in one era. We have to keep moving forward. And we all hear sustainability. Sustainability is what farmers do every day and what we've been doing for years. Again, if we had not been using sustainable practices from Jamestown, Virginia would not be productive right now. And I feel like Virginia has some of the best, most productive soils, you know, anywhere in the nation. And very diversified, as I said before.
Oh, it's a wonderful place to be. And then it's amazing that like the little Thomas Jefferson things that are tucked in there, not just Monticello, but then Poplar Forest. And anywhere you drive in Virginia, you see these signs for something Civil War history, or, you know, it's an incredible state to be in and so diverse.
We're located on the route of Lee's Retreat, and we farm Five Forks. So Five Forks was pretty instrumental towards the end of the Civil War, and we actually farm on that original land too. The house is still standing. The owners of the house, they still have the portraits from their ancestors, and it has slash marks through the portraits where the soldiers came in and slashed them. So yes, a lot of rich history here.
Do you find artifacts in your fields or anything like that as you're farming? I'm super curious. I mean, I guess you're not digging, so you're probably not pulling things up, but do you find other artifacts?
Yeah, we've found a, just walk in the field sometimes, you know, I'll see a mini ball that's surfaced. my son, my other son, he has a house up the road from us also. And just walking around his house one day, and there's a mini ball laying on top of the ground after a heavy rain.
You said you were talking about some of the Native American practices in the area too. I mean, are there other things that have carried over from historically that are soil health oriented that you're maybe using now to some degree?
Well, I don't know all the practices of Thomas Jefferson, but I think he was very ahead of his time also at Monticello and some of the practices that he incorporated. And from what I've heard, at one time, he even raised cotton, you know, at Monticello, which is, you know, that is mountainous in that area. But I don't think we could do it now with the equipment we have. If it was still being picked by hand, that's one thing, but you wouldn't be able to do it with the equipment now.
Right. I'm curious about your, you know, because I assume you deal with several landlords, given the size that, you know, you're leasing for your farm. Are most of them families that have had that land for that long? And I'm just kind of curious the sort of the makeup of the type of landlord that has farm ground in your area that you're renting from.
Yes, some of the landlords, the farms have been in their families for generations also. And as we tell people, back in the day, you have to think probably in the 30s to probably maybe 60s. You know, a farmer in this area could probably raise 5 acres of tobacco, feed their family, send their children to school, and you made a very decent living. And now, with the margins being so low, they've had to get out of it and rent that land out. So we have fields that range from, you know, 2 acres to 100 acres. When we go to write our rent checks, we have, I think we're right around 50 landlords now. And you have to think about that. That's 50 families at one time. You know, they did produce enough on their small acreage to support themselves.
Yeah, it's times have changed so much. How have the priorities of those landlords changed, if at all, with kind of different generations taking on the land? Do they have different ideas about how it should be farmed, maybe even different interests in things like soil health?
The struggle now is keeping it in production. Unfortunately, as the older generation passes, a lot of their children now has moved away. The family farms does not have the meaning that when our generation grew up, you want to keep it intact. But now people are they're in different cities, they're in different states, and they just want to see the benefit of a sale. They want to see the monetary benefit. They don't have the attachment that people used to have with their farm. Right now, we don't have any solar panels, but that's something it's a big deal around here. We have to watch for that. And then this houses. You know, people are steady moving out to the country, and they are, you know, say a farmland that might go for $5,000 an acre. You can sell it for a house lot, and it'll be $25,000 an acre. And if they have no ties any longer, it is being sold. You know, that generation is moving on, and hopefully, you know, we can keep what we have intact, and we want to keep growing. Just right now, we have neighboring farmers, and we try to be respectful of each other and not go behind anyone and, you know, support each other on that.
Is it difficult knowing, you know, that you're renting land and it could be sold for a housing lot or something like that? Is it difficult to do soil health practices and do those inputs and make that effort on that land? Or how long are your leases? You know, does that play into what practices you use on different pieces of land?
We try to keep it productive no matter what. Most of our landowners, if they see something in the future, they usually notify us, you know, a year in advance. Let us know, and then we just know then, okay, we won't, you know, spend a lot of extra inputs. So the landlords we have are excellent to work with, and we do try to, you know, make their land more profitable. We want to keep it productive, profitable for ourselves, but in turn, if they do turn around and sell it, they've got a good piece of property that someone will be purchasing.
And you were talking about kind of bringing back new ideas and being open to new ideas. What types of things are you considering or talking about or thinking about or experimenting with on the farm right now? Things that might, you know, be relevant in the future for you?
Right now, the buzzword is biologicals. We did some testing this year in the corn crop and the soybean crop. We did some test strips, and I'm very intrigued by that right now. And I think that could be the future to utilize, you know, wake up all the productive microbes we have in the soils right now that's maybe been locked up. And this is a way to, you know, cut cost and also help the environment.
And is that for, you know, biological inputs or for like soil amendments or both?
What we're using now is a foliar applied biologicals, you know, pull nitrogen in, you know, and again, and wake up the microbes. And, you know, in our area, it has been a lot of litter, you know, which sometimes ties up some of the nutrients. And that's what they're looking at also. And we also do grid sampling, you know, try to pinpoint, you know, the needs where we need to apply more nutrients.
This is really interesting, Susan. And Abby and I have said this a million times, but like you're probably close to the 20th or so interview we've had for this series, and every single one has been interesting and every single one has been different. And if you can't tell, I'm just like, my wheels are just turning with this history that is just trying to comprehend. It's really, really cool. What a neat part of the world to be from and to farm in. We do like to ask, though, before we close out any interview, if you could just have one message to an audience of other farmers that are at, you know, varying points in their soil health journey, what would you want your message to be to get out there to other farmers and people who are working with farmers to build healthier soils?
I think just, again, be proactive and work with your neighbors, work with your extension. You know, go online, research, look at videos. There's so many places you can go now for information. And I think in the past, you know, a farmer didn't want to share their knowledge. But I think we're seeing now that farmers are a whole lot more open to what works for them. And if somebody asks, they will share that information. In the past, I think everybody's kind of been secretive about what they do. But now we all need to work together, you know, to save our environment and keep our industry strong and growing. We've got to team up on this and be productive and educate people. We're making the right moves. We're using the best practices, you know, not only for ourselves, but for generations to come and for the future environment. We're not doing anything to be detrimental. And I think that's what I would like to see our everyday consumers understand, you know, where their food comes from, the hard work we do put into it. And the technology is changing to benefit us all.
Absolutely. Susan, this has been great. Anything else, though, that we didn't get to or that you want to emphasize before we let you go?
I guess we covered it all. I guess that's the biggest thing is we just always tell people our land should be wore out here in Virginia since we've been farming so long. But, you know, again, good practices, it's here. And as long as we get the rainfall, we can compete with probably any state in the nation. We laugh, we say we have tree lines that suck some of our moisture out of the field. So our yields go down on the edges, but we have good soils and we're very diverse. So Virginia, I tell people we don't have the production acreage like out west, but we've got the people in the ports and we're very, very important to the agricultural industry.
Well, what a cool look at farming in Virginia there. I just love the history that Susan was able to share. And it's pretty telling that after seven generations or more, their soil is more productive than ever. Thank you so much to Susan Watkins for being on the show today. Now, before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. The show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuet, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow this show on your favorite podcast app and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.